Bloody amazing sausage that is. Look at the state of it.
VLN2's already started.
Yeah, I've got that on the TV.
Yeah,
that's why I'm running the Skype call off my phone, because I don't dare try and stream video and use Skype at the same time.
Well, I've got, because we're on fiber here, so I've got VLN, but unfortunately, SkyNZ's web interface is a piece of shit, so I was hoping to get the fucking the Formula 2 race up on a second screen, but I think I'll just have to record it and catch it later. Because this is the week that everything has started. Literally every series has just gone right. First week in April, let's go. Fucking game on. So we've got Formula 1, Formula 2, IndyCar, MotoGP, V8 Supercars, Super GT, British Touring Cars, World Touring Cars. What have I forgotten? Blancpain GT, VLN, and the World Endurance Championship prologue down in Paul Ricard. There's probably others, but all those things are happening simultaneously. Oh, and the World Rally Championship are in Corsica, so good times.
It's a bit busy.
It is a bit busy, and I'm a completist. I like to be across everything, so this means I'm going to be spending the rest of the fucking week catching up on all the shit that I haven't seen. Because so much of it's available on the interwebs now, so it's hard to avoid.
A lot of it is available on the internet.
Before we were talking, I was literally watching a live stage from Corsica, where Seb Loeb has proven that while he might be quick enough, he's doesn't quite have the attention to detail he used to, because he's sort of had a little bingle in the last two rallies that has meant that his old sparring partner Seb Ogier has been able to embarrass him, which I'm sure he. They've got a deep-seated feud that goes back to when Ogier got run out of Citroën while he was thinking he was going to be the guy to replace Loeb, and they sort of just stick with Loeb, and they ran Ogier out the paint, so good times.
Can I admit that I have not given a shit about rally in about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years?
That's all right. And most of it's probably Seb Loeb's fault, because he was so good that he ruined it for everyone. That was
actually probably it.
Yeah, just like Schumacher did for Formula One for a generation. You know, he was just so good. It was just, it became... There was no thrill in watching anymore. I mean, some people like to watch for the sort of the purest kind of look at somebody doing a fantastic job. But I mean, there were a lot
of really, really fucking dull races.
There's a lot of hours to spend out of your life watching something that you know, watching transmuting sightings.
Mm.
And I think that's probably why. I think that might be part of the reason why Alonso was held up as the superhero genius that everyone that. You know, Formula One in general hold him up for, even though his record is not that of, you know, he's not even as good as Vettel or Hamilton. It's because he was the guy who finally slayed the beast. He was the one who took down Schumacher when Schumacher was at the peak of his powers.
That's probably true, because Alonso only won, what, two championships?
Mm.
But he did do it back-to-back.
He did it back-to-back. He did have the
which is always impressive.
He did have the advantage of some pretty trick Michelin tyres, but then again, Schumacher had Bridgestone's built for him for most of the last 5 years.
Forever.
So, yeah, exactly. So, So, Formula One is on in Bahrain, which is Bernie Eccleston's kind of place. Ferraris appear to be quick, having not necessarily been that quick, but having gotten away with the win in Melbourne after, again, Mercedes weren't able to work out that a full course yellow means that somebody else can make a pit stop without having to spend any time doing anything else. You would think that they would have got across that by, I don't know, watching a WEC race, but apparently not.
No, it was that race was really forgettable.
Yeah.
I found.
Well, Albert Park these days is not a very raceable circuit. And I don't know whether you can make any changes to it to make it raceable, but even with three DRS zones, there just aren't enough places to get one Formula One car past another.
And I bet some of that comes back to just Formula One cars, you can't get them close. You can very rarely get them close to each other, so you can do that.
But even in the V8 supercars, it wasn't as though those guys were slingshotting past each other all the time. I mean, a lot of the major events were people throwing it down the road, like Scotty Mack spearing off across the sand trap and costing himself a probable win in one of the races there. So I mean, it's a lovely place for a race, but it's not a it's not a great layout, unfortunately.
No, I think it's time has kind of come in terms of it providing interesting racing. Like the thing about Albert Park is, like back in the late 90s when it was first on the calendar, is that what you get, you might not even have got a great race then, but what you got was, you know, half the field grenading
yeah,
at some point during the race.
Because it was race one.
because it was race one, and that was exciting. Now, these cars are pretty bulletproof.
Yeah, I mean, they've got...
Aside from maybe the Haas.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to last... They've got to, you know, last the season on three engines and three gearboxes. I mean, Hamilton's going to drop five... Hamilton's going to drop five places because he needs a new gearbox here in Bahrain. It seems that Ferrari have got good short-run pace... Red Bull have got good long-run pace, and the Mercedes are going to be trying to carve through from the back. So it has the prospects of being a pretty good race. And Bahrain, oddly enough, even though it's a Tilke circuit, it's actually not a bad racing circuit.
It's one of his better efforts.
Yeah, I mean, it's basic as fuck, but it's still... you can always tell because if it's a sort of place where they have really good Formula 2 or GP2 races, and the F2 races and GP2 races have always been really good at Bahrain, and even the Viet Supercar race they had there, which was on kind of the half-size track, was decent. Not enough to keep the...
I can't even remember it. I know I watched it, but I cannot remember it. Just like I can't remember the year they went to Abu Dhabi for some fucking reason.
Oh, I mean, and they've been to Austin. I mean, the places they've been to China. The places that V8 Supercars, and it will appear to be V8 Supercars for the duration, given that... it appears to be the Holden head office, General Motors head office, said, no, we're not spending any more money on fucking engines, boys. You know, we're not spending another couple of million bucks to develop a V8 supercar specific head for the twin turbo.
That was big news for us when that broke on was it Friday afternoon?
Yeah, and it seemed that the insider word was that Auto Action had the closest to the truth version of what was going on, in terms of the fact that it was at least that was the word out of various insiders, that it was less about not being able to get the engine to work, because I understand that they were able to get good power out of it. It's just that it wasn't doing it with very good fuel economy, and there were cooling issues, and there was some longevity issues. But I mean, they could get the power out of it, but it was just... it was going to be a lot more expensive if they wanted to turn it into an engine that you could just have, you know, you could alternate with a V8 engine and there wouldn't be any real performance difference. And that's sort of the point, isn't it? I mean, why spend all that money to end up with an engine that just gives you the same as what you've already fucking got?
It's a point because it's a sign that the series hasn't got right the new direction that it wants to take.
Well, the manufacturers aren't coming along with it. I mean, that seems very clear. The new manufacturers aren't that interested.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, Holden isn't developing a car. Nissan's certainly not developing a car.
Well, Nissan... I mean, is Nissan definitely going, or are they just sort of... do you think they might just sort of quietly back away?
I strongly suspect we'll see that Nissan will announce that they won't be signing a new deal with the series at the end of the current one, which is at the end of this year.
Yeah.
That'll be it.
Because
the Kellys will be running Commodores next year.
Yeah, or they might just be running debadged Ultimas, like that year that that 888 ran Falcons, but they pulled the badges off them and put something. They put like Hog's Breath bloody logos on them, and then they switched to to Holden pretty shortly afterwards. It's the factory team, but there was some coverage that was sort of positioning it as sort of a power play that 888 wanted the turbo and Zach Brown wasn't that keen on the turbo, and obviously, and Walkinshaws weren't that keen on the turbo, and it was sort of a power play between the teams. But I mean, I'm inclined to believe it was sort of Holden going, oh no, we're lucky to be in business in this country, let alone, you know, throwing money, making a different sounding engine that people don't really have a lot of support for. I think it's a real shame because I would have loved to have seen the turbo. I would have loved to have heard the turbo. They sound fantastic in the admittedly very differently exhausted, but they sounded fantastic in the old Cadillac GT3s, which no longer run because Stefan Rattel got in the ear of the Pirelli World Challenge people and said no more factory teams in GT3 racing. So Cadillac were quietly invited to go fuck themselves, which is a damn shame because they were lovely cars.
Yeah, they were the little I saw of them. I think that the thing with the Holden engine is that it's kind of, although this is a racing story, it's kind of symbolic of the bigger Holden picture in that they are so screwed.
They're not going well.
They're not going well. I mean, you mentioned Auto Action before, and I've just got the story in front of me, and like market share is falling off a cliff. They are moving exactly no cars.
Yeah, they're not shifting new Commodores. And the problem is they've got such a weird, disparate offering. And a lot of this stuff just turned up. Like, I drive past the Holden dealership occasionally, and actually most days. And this thing called an Equinox popped up on their thing. Like, new old Equinox. Like, what's the Equinox? What the fuck's that? Is that like a Captiva? Is that like a big Captiva? Is that like a Colorado? Is that like... But then the Colorado's now that... The Colorado 7's now the Trailblazer, and there's the European Astra, but there's also this sedan Astra, which looks like, I think, is the Cruze with a different badge on it, which obviously looks cheap and shitty.
It's Holden's problem is that they've gone, you know, our strength is that we can go and pick cars from across the GM empire and just, you know, like take the best ones. And what they've ended up with is just this random assortment of just mediocre crap.
Well, they were talking about having a whole bunch of new cars.
New 20 new cars by 2024 or something. Like,
what's the fucking point if nobody wants to buy any of them? I mean, they do make some good stuff. I had the Astra, the current European Astra, as a rental car for, I can't remember where I was. Oh, no, it was in Sydney. I had it for 2 weeks in Sydney. It was a gorgeous thing. It was built solid. In fact, when I was over in Australia last week, I had a Golf, and I think the Astra compares very well to the Golf. You know, it's a good car, but I'm not seeing any of them around the streets. So
no, because people are buying things like the Hyundai i30 instead,
or they're buying Mazda 3s, which people seem to buy the arse out.
Or they're buying Mazda 3s, which every second person seems to buy one of those.
Ford Foci, and of course, they're spending more money in buying fucking A series Mercs and 1 series BMWs and Minis and you know, people are sort of going the value add if they're buying new cars at all.
If you're in the inner west of Sydney, you buy a Renault Clio RS for some reason.
Oh, all right.
There are hundreds of the bastards around there.
Really?
Yeah, that's weird.
That is weird because I think Renault effectively aren't in the New Zealand market. I'm sure you could get one on special order via Nissan, but it'd be much more common to see a Peugeot, because Peugeot have always had reasonable market share over here for some reason.
I always get excited when I say a Peugeot because it happens so infrequently. Well, someone bought a Peugeot. Good on you.
Well, the Peugeot deal is the same as the Volkswagen, Nissan, Skoda dealer. So you see the Subaru dealer. So you see the sort of bizarre mixture of cars on the forecourt of this place. It's actually the Nissan dealer we bought our X-Trail from 5-6 years ago now. But so Nissan are probably just going to quietly back away because it just doesn't. Even though supercars is held up as this great success story around the world, their manufacturers can't sell cars through promotion in V8 supercars. If they could, they would.
Especially given that none of the cars in V8 supercars you can actually buy.
Well, you used to be able to buy Ultimas. I don't know if you still can
buy a
V8
Ultima. Engine, you couldn't.
Oh, no, God, no. Not with rear-wheel drive.
And now you can't buy a V8 Commodore, and you certainly can't buy a V8 Falcon.
Well, you can buy
a V8. Who exactly are they trying to sell cars to?
Buy a V8 Falcon if you go to fucking, you know.
Country.
Yeah. Go to the auction, see if you can pick up the last of the V8 Fairmonts. And how much of that is important? It gets down to that question of what are factories get involved with motorsport for? Is it just promotion? Is it R&D? Is it just brand halo?
I'd say for a series like the supercars, it is absolutely a marketing exercise.
For sure, you're not getting any R&D done.
They're not getting any R&D done. There's nothing to be learned racing these cars. It's all about it's the old win on Sunday, sell on Monday that the series kind of grew out of.
Yeah. But now
they've got nothing to sell after they win on Sunday.
Yes. And even if they did, people wouldn't go and buy it because it's not like those are the cars that are selling. I mean, sedans haven't been the cars.
And we're unlikely to see sort of a Hyundai Tucson Mazda CX-5 series take off anytime soon.
No. I mean, do you remember they tried to do that with the Australian Rally Championship? They wanted to have like a soft rotor category. And I think it was
I don't remember hearing about this, but I don't know anything about it.
It never got anywhere because everyone just went, nah, man. And that's why they've all kind of gravitated to this AP4 kind of model, which is the same as what they use over here in New Zealand, which are kind of, but they're basically just sort of a set. It's a space, probably a space frame, but it's sort of a set or four-wheel drive chassis. You put a manufacturer engine in it, you put manufacturer bodywork on it, and you go rallying. And they're cheap as, and they produce pretty good, you know, they're pretty good rally cars. You know, that you can sort of performance match them against, you know, Group N cars, so it's fair. I know in the New Zealand Rally Championship, the AP4 cars and the Group N cars are pretty... I mean, they've got different strengths because the Group N cars tend to be longer wheelbase, more torque, but air restrictors to reduce the power. So the Rally Otago, which is the first round of the New Zealand Championship, is on here next week. And a fellow by the name of Hayden Paddon, a young Kiwi kid who's... doing some stuff in the World Rally Championship. He's still got a part-time job with the Hyundai Rally Team. He's going to be flogging around. But he actually came down one year and won the event outright in a BDA Escort that was older than... that was about the age of me. That was amazing. Beating fucking Group N spec Lancers and WRXs in this fucking roaring BDA Escort. It was just... amazing to watch him because
that's fantastic. I've spoken to people that have spent some time with him and say that he is such a good guy. Like, he's one of those genuinely yeah. nice blokes. He's a good sport. He has fun. He just obviously enjoys what he does.
Yeah, I think I mean not to generalize, but I think a lot of the Kiwis in motorsport tend to be like that. You feel like Brendan Hartley is just a big nerd, and Scott Dixon's boring as shit. You know, these people, and they're not Nick Kyrgios, you know.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time a New Zealand racing driver, you know, New Zealand anything, you sort of, you know, had a blow up off. And, you know, punched a bellhop in a hotel or something like that.
Well, there is always Shane Van Gisbergen, who's just out making friends. But I think he might have a touch of the spectrum. If you look into his eyes on those interviews, you do wonder what's in there. But Jesus, he's quick though. Although they had a mysterious day there with 97.
It was weird because he started off all right. Obviously, he was leading, then decided to pit after five laps.
That was a bad strategy call, and nothing went right after that because the pit stop wasn't quick.
Well, then he came out at like two laps after his pit stop. He set the fastest lap of the race and broke the lap record, which was set last year by Lowndes or someone.
Yeah,
and then went nowhere.
Yeah, you know. I think he had a little lose and dropped a few places, but it was just a remarkably lackluster performance from him because the 888 cars were very quick. And it was a day where they had the measure of Penske and Scott McLaughlin was down the field, and it was a good opportunity to rack up some points. I mean, he still finished ahead of McLaughlin, but it's funny with him.
Scott McLaughlin was probably the one who was having a worse day than him.
Well, the funny thing is that at one point, when they were coming out of the pits, they banged wheels and he almost put him in the fence. These guys are friends. I mean, McLaughlin's 12-hour drive came about because Van Giz hooked him up with the team and said, you should come and drive with us. This will be really cool. So it's and obviously their careers have run parallel from New Zealand touring car stuff. SVG got his start earlier because he was in V8 supercars when he was fucking 18, wasn't he? 17? Very young. Yeah. Stone Brothers got him across. But it's kind of... You know, once you get past those sort of big early season events, it's actually kind of nice to get into the almost like the home and away season of the V8 supercars, the regional, the Wintons and the fucking
except Winton's fucking terrible.
I know it's terrible, but Simmons is a good little track. Simmons is a good little track because it has that great combination of that hairpin, and then you can almost do a switchback, but it takes you most of the length of the straight to enact it out. And the other great thing about the sort of the regional rounds, sort of further away from the capitals, is you get these bogus fucking shed-built sports car support series. Like, there was one of those, like, all-comers kind of sport GT.
Yeah, Run What You Brung.
So there's, like, a R32 Skyline and a RX-7 and clearly what used to be a V8 supercar from about 8 years ago and...
Yeah, there was definitely a VE Series 2 running around. Yeah.
Well, there was
possibly an old Datsun something.
It was a BF, and somebody had a Piranha Capri from about 1973. And it was I don't know how you BOP this. I don't know how you get that all to work. But
I don't think you bother. You just go on, have some fun.
Go out and fuck some shit up. Yeah, and of course the touring car masters who will turn up to anything anywhere, which is one of the great charming elements that they have to them. But yeah, it was it's been an interesting year so far in the V8s, and we're just going to keep calling them the V8s because that's what we're stuck with. There was a lot of pissing and moaning, particularly from weird vampire man,
Ryan Story,
about the fact that Triple Eight had homologated the new Commodore with composite roof and composite this and that the other, and it wasn't fair and it was all a rot. And then by the next round, they'd come up with composite panels for all those things and were allowed to run them, and didn't make any fucking difference to their performance. So it was kind of the usual kind of, if you're not going that well, make a distraction sort of tactic, which is...
Oh, yeah.
Not really what Penske do, so I'm not sure what felt a little
but
bit... More...
But it's certainly what I imagine would have come out of Dick Johnson's
yeah,
garage.
Yeah, it's certainly...
Or actually, I'm surprised it didn't come from Tim Edwards at Tickford.
It is very Tim...
Because he's usually the top for that sort of shit.
Very Tim Edwards areas. I saw he was interviewed at the end of the race. I didn't have the sound on, but he was sort of sitting down with his arms crossed, looking like he was having a sulk. But he didn't have anyone to blame because the car... It was just... They just had no fucking pace. Which is odd.
Yeah, they had no pace in practice. They had no pace in qualifying.
Yeah, and I think they also had a few fuck-ups. And Chaz Mostert's car caught on fire, which none of these things are things you want.
No, that fire was weird.
Almost all of those things are bad.
That fire was strange. I don't know what happened. He seemed to have said, oh, I had some contact, and then like the car just caught on fire.
It was almost like a fractured fuel union or it pushed
what
something.
What I suspect is it might have shaved some of the composite bullshit, on the door or something over the exhaust.
Yeah, yeah, I was just thinking that, yeah.
Back, so he's sitting in the pit stop and that's just got hot.
It's just heat sank and lit it up and good times. Yeah, that's entirely possible.
He looked awful coming out of that for 10 or 15 minutes after he got out of the car.
Oh, well, if it's burning composites, then that's going to make you feel... That's going to really fuck with you. It's really unpleasant. So SVG is leading the championship again, and Lowndes is quick again, and it's almost like we're back in 2016. It's like the...
Isn't Tuchel leading the championship now? He won?
No, because he fucked it on the... Saturday in...
No, it is still Shane Van Gisbergen,
yeah,
I take it all.
Well, if anything, it would be...
Hockwagen.
Dafydd, yes, because Dafydd has been very... has been super, super consistent. But it certainly seems that the move back to the 2016 tyre construction has brought Lowndes back as a force, where he absolutely wasn't last year, which is good for marketing. I don't know whether Lowndes is still the same... fan hero that he was. I think he's kind of faded a little bit in that respect, but it is still useful from a PR perspective to have him around in that way.
Oh yeah, like he's still easily the biggest name in the sport.
Yeah, it's also because guys like Wincup have never really in. It's a bit like, I suppose, Jimmy Johnson's the obvious comparison in NASCAR. He's just not. You know he's there and you know he's good. It's impossible not to see that because of the level of talent, but you don't know him. As a fan, he's not knowable. You don't know who...
Yeah, he's just not that personable.
Well, you don't even know if he's a person. I mean, most of the other people, at least you'll see something of him. You know who Shane Van Gisbergen is. You know what sort of bloke he is. He's a bloke who can't be out of a car. You know who David Reynolds is, for better or for worse, and often for worse. But at least you know who he is. You don't... Because Wincup is so deliberately beige and so buttoned down with his emotions... And the thing is, I mean, if you look back on the things that Wincup has done in a race car, like winning Adelaide the week after his old man passed away, 5 or 6 years ago, if that was a guy who was knowable, if he was a guy who actually shared his emotions and was kind of, it let down the guard a little bit, that would have been a much bigger deal. But it's kind of hard to judge who he is, and that makes it difficult to warm to him, because humans. I mean, I was in a work thing where we're talking about how you engage with the media and how you engage with the public and how do you communicate to the public. And the reality is that it's, as you know in your line of work, it's all about humans. Humans want to know about humans. Humans want something human to engage with. They need something to empathize with, something to understand, and. At its base, all of sport is a human interest story. It's about who you care about seeing win and who you care about seeing lose. And I don't imagine there are any passionate Jamie Wincup fans.
I'd like to meet a passionate Jamie Wincup fan. Well, I think that would be fantastic.
Well, that was why what blew up at the end of last year, where he split with his fiance, and he said, I'm rededicating myself. I got rid of the distractions and stuff, and it was such a brutal thing to say about somebody who you were going to spend the rest of your life with. And I remember Tony Stewart said something a lot like that when his marriage or his engagement broke down. But
I assume with Tony Stewart, it's because he's just fucking mad.
It's because he's mad. He probably, she probably was drinking moonshine or something. But again, Tony Stewart was a guy who you knew
was mad.
Yeah, well, you understood who he was. Kyle Busch is like that. But it's not. It's. I'm not saying everyone has to be starting fights in pit lane. But I mean, who the fuck are you outside the car? Are you just and a lot of racing car drivers now are robots outside the car, and they don't have any other interests. But it does make it not everyone could be Dan Ricciardo, but you can at least fucking try.
Yeah, there's something, because if you certainly don't have that level of engagement, like interest in watching people just drive around in circles fast, and that's what car racing is. Like, these guys drive around in circles for hours on end. That's fine. We like it. That's cool. Yeah. But if there's no engagement, if there's nothing to sort of make you want to go and watch this.
If there's no reason to care.
If there's no reason to care, then you're not going to.
Yeah. What are we going to do if we don't care? I mean, that's also why MotoGP has such a strong advantage over a lot, you know, over, say, Formula One. It's got a great potential to engage because the humans, you can see the humans. You can see their body language. You can see their eyes through the helmet. And because it's such a gladiatorial sport, they tend to give more of themselves in interviews, and you tend to know the sort of people they are. And often because of the structure of the series where you've got Moto2, Moto3, you see them grow up. And I remember one of the great pleasures of watching MotoGP through the years for me has been watching Valentino Rossi go from being this ridiculous little kid with terrible fucking hair in 20 years ago to, you know, an elder statesman, this legend of the sport. And that's been my entire, you know, I watched MotoGP before he was around because, of, you know, Gardner and Doohan versus the Americans, you know, the Swansons and the Rainies and people like that. But Rossi kind of defines a lot of my MotoGP watching.
And certainly for me.
Yeah.
Like, I remember, like, I sort of caught the end of Doohan's career. Yeah. Sort of like my, you know, my earliest memories, I think, I can't remember who his teammate was, but running him off the track at Eastern Creek.
Oh, yeah, him and Alex Creville.
That's the one.
Because he always used to, because Mick liked to destroy a teammate as much as anybody, and he used to, you know, accuse Creville of just being a caravan. He'd just get towed around the place. He couldn't lead by and make the pace. He had to follow somebody else around. I liked Creville, but, you know, he was a bit of a, once Mick wasn't around to set the bike up and everything, he was a little bit lost, and Honda did need to bring in Rossi as quickly as they could in order to start winning again.
Yeah, but it went from Doohan and that to then Rossi with a brief interlude with Casey Stoner when he popped up and did his thing for a couple of years.
Yeah. So there have been Rossi and, Lorenzo was, there was like a couple of years where Rossi won, 2001 through 5, and then Nicky Hayden won 06, Stoner won 07, and then Rossi won another couple. I think there was a Lorenzo title or two in there as well, and then latterly we've had the run of Marquez. And the problem with Marquez is that he is so ridiculously talented that he doesn't need anything that even looks like the best setup bike. He can just take a Honda. And Honda's, I mean, the odd thing about MotoGP that I've been watching for all these years is that the factories retain their characteristics. Like, Yamaha still prioritise certain things, like that they will always be the best handling bike, they'll always turn the best. Admittedly, they're having a few chassis problems now trying to get on with the Michelin. Honda care about the engine first and foremost. So they'll build these bikes. This is going back to Wayne Gardner and Eddie Lawson days back in the 500s with these two-stroke things that would try to kill you. They had the most power, but they would be trying to kill you for the entire duration. And the Hondas that Marquez has been riding in the last couple of years, no one else can get on with. And the reason is because they require you to ride in a way that means you're losing the front and the rear at all times. Which sort of brings us to the end of last year, the title decider, where for all intents and purposes, Marquez should have crashed the bike. He had a complete front end lose that he propped up on his knee on the fastest corner on the track, and somehow managed to ride out of it and went on to win the title. No one else can do that, which is going to be Honda's problem if they ever lose Marquez, or if Marquez ever, you know, if Marquez gets, you know, breaks his leg halfway through the season. They don't have anybody who can take the fight to Ducati and Yamaha.
Yeah, I've got to watch them all, MotoGP. I think they're also racing this weekend.
They are. They're in Argentina, and Marquez is well up the road from everyone else. The Ducatis are way off the pace. for some reason. Dovizioso. I've really enjoyed watching Dovizioso's development too, because he sort of came in. He was a rival with Lorenzo back in the day. I got him out of GP, and he never really made it, and he was always kind of a journeyman. But the last year or so, he's just suddenly found another gear, and it's really cool to see somebody have such a dramatic late career evolution as a rider. It's just it's nice that it's not all these, you know. As an old person, it's nice to see old people succeed at stuff.
You're relating a little bit there.
That's why I'm clinging to Valentino Rossi's career for as long as I can.
The only real thing that gets me excited about MotoGP is the weekend at Mugello, because that is always just the best.
Yes, Mugello is tremendous. I mean, Phillip Island's tremendous too, but normally it's
Phillip Island is good, but Mugello, especially Moto3 and Moto2,
yeah,
are just the best racing you will ever see.
Well, it was like when they used to go to Hockenheim and place, and when World Superbikes used to go to Monza. With those big old slipstreamy circuits, you knew it was going to come down to the last lap. You knew it was going to come down to the last corner. And the geography of the racetrack meant that you knew roughly, you know, they were going to have to try it here, or they're going to have to try it here. It's a little bit like watching for listeners to our other sporting podcasts, a bit like watching a really good basketball game where you know it's going to come down to the last shot, but you want to see how it gets there. And that's really how, you know, Mugello was always the absolute... Almost the absolute fucking
highlights. You've got to be about four or five back coming out of the last corner, because you just have that 3 kilometres of slipstream to just slingshot past everyone.
Yeah, but sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's funny to see the first round in Qatar was like that, of MotoGP, because they've got that incredibly long straight. And Moto2 and Moto3 were both won on the line, but it different strategies worked. And again, in MotoGP, it was sort of this thing that sort of come up a few times, which is Marquez tries desperately to barrel past Dovizioso. Dovizioso sort of sets it up, lets him swing on through like a dickhead, and then Dovizioso sort of cuts back and powers on. And he's managed to win like 3 different races that way, which is odd, because you'd think that if either of them would have the psychological wood, it'd be Marquez, who's not scared of anything or anybody. I mean, he started a fight with Valentino Rossi for no reason at all, except for the fact that he just felt like it, and pretty much cost Rossi his last shot at a championship a few years ago.
That's always fun.
Yeah, it's a thing to do. Sure.
I mean, sometimes they have these really long gaps between races, and you've got to fill the time somehow.
Yeah, this is true. And sometimes it's almost as much as 2 weeks. Because they're running, like, 21 rounds this year? Is it
Formula? I've got the calendar open in front of me, and it goes all the way through to the middle of the end of November.
They're going to be so busy. They're just going to be so busy.
Unfortunately, after Argentina, they go to Circuit of the Americas, which is...
Yeah, COTA. Although COTA's not a bad bike track, except for the fact that the Formula One cars have left pimples and lumps all through it. Marquez has never lost a MotoGP race there, so you can pencil that one in for him as well. But then I always feel that the MotoGP season doesn't start until they get to Jerez in Spain. Because it's always been a really good race, and then that starts off that run of they go to Le Mans and Mugello.
They go to Le Mans, Mugello, Catalonia, yeah. Assen. Assen's yes. always yeah. mad.
Even though they've kind of neutered the track with the top end of the circuit out a couple of years ago, and you have that night long run of really cool circuits, and they just seem to have the most fun, and it is a great evening of motorsport watching a MotoGP. With the two and the MotoGPs as well.
Yeah.
You don't really get that. I mean, you kind of get that with Formula One.
It's actually a really good TV package.
Yeah. I think it works better than Formula One's at the moment.
It's like each race is what, about half an hour, 45 minutes?
Yeah, 40 minutes,
So you can get that up, then you can go and have your dinner and sit down, watch the next one, and then have your nightcap and then watch the next one.
Yeah. I know, it's a good package. And Formula One have kind of got that with GP3, Formula 2, but then there's a long break before the Formula 1, and they take it so seriously. You know, they're an hour and a half of fucking pregame. It's just a Formula 1 race. The guy on pole will probably win. So
yes.
You get that. So Super GT starts this weekend. I'm really looking forward to that, because those things are bullshit. Jenson Button is full-timing it now. Kamui Kobayashi's full-timing it there as well. Of course, the young Kiwi Nick Cassidy and the gun Japanese kid Hirakawa are the reigning champions for the Lexus team. It looks like Honda might have got their shit together. Traditionally, of course, being Honda, they've got the most powerful engine, but they couldn't get the thing to fucking work on the tyres they were running. It looks like from pre-season testing and from qualifying, they've locked out the front row. They're Honda.
I tried to get the website to work before we started recording it. It's just refusing to work for me, so that's good.
No, I'm just remembering what I saw on Twitter. But that should be fun. I mean, the funny thing is that Okayama, the track they're going to race at, was a dog of a track in Formula One. It was crap. But the thing about Super GT cars is they can race on anything. They're just incredibly raceable cars. So it'll be a good race. I'm sure of it.
Jenson Button will be starting fifth.
He's good fifth. It was pissing down rain in qualifying. So.
Oh, good. Hopefully it's doing that tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that with a tyre war, somebody is always going to have some weird advantage, like on the full wet, and then somebody else will have a massive advantage on the intermediate just because their tyre company has done a cleverer job of setting this shit up. But it certainly looks like, on the dry pace that they had in testing, it looked like the Hondas were going to make some noise, so... That could be good because they've sucked for a long time.
According to this, the Yokohama, the Hondas are on Bridgestone.
Some of them are on Bridgestone. Some of them are on Yokohama.
There's one.
Huh.
One Honda on a Yokohama in 12th.
They must have pulled out of the... Oh, Yokohama's wet. Must be a piece of shit.
That's Bridgestone, Bridgestone, Michelin, Bridgestone, Bridgestone, Yokohama, Yokohama, Michelin.
There should be one Honda on Dunlop, I think. It's like an orphan.
Yes, he's 13th.
And it was the one that actually won races last year. It was one of the few that actually got anywhere. It won't,
featuring the best driver, one of the better driver names, Bertrand Baguette.
Yeah, Bertie Baguette. Yeah. Because I think they won Suzuka, the Suzuka 1000, the last Suzuka 1000 before it becomes the GT3 race for Stefan Rattel's empire of nonsense. Speaking
That's
of which,
sad.
Blanc. Oh, well, but they're also, I think the problem was that they kind of figured out that 1,000 kilometres around Suzuka in effectively LMP1 machinery in terms of pace was just not tenable anymore. So they're just going to make Suzuka a standard length 300k race, and they've added an extra long endurance race at Fuji. So they're doing a 500 miler at Fuji as well as their traditional 500k race. And Fuji's entirely appropriate for that kind of shit. You know, we can cope with it much, much more effectively than Suzuka, which is ridiculously narrow when you see it. That's the great thing about those Japanese circuits is that some of them just look like club circuits in Britain. You know, they look like Alton Park or Brands Hatch Indy or something. You know, they look preposterous, and they've got these monstrous fit things racing around them. British touring cars are on this weekend, so that's another fucking series. British Superbike started last week.
What do they race in British touring cars these days? Have they gone TCR yet?
No, they don't want to go TCR. So they've got what is probably more like, because it's run by Alan Gow, who's got a lot of history in Australian touring cars. So it's kind of a supercard version of the previous World Touring Car Championship sort of stuff. So mostly 2-litre or 1.6-litre turbos. But they do offer a standard chassis, standard engine for anyone who wants to build up a car for a manufacturer that doesn't want to support the series. So they have some factories, you know, that have involvement, like Subaru are in there, and BMW supports some teams, and you know, various other things. But people can just build, you know, if they get with manufacturer approval, not necessarily support. There's like some Mercedes A-classes in there, and there's MGs and Audis and Vauxhalls and Ford Focuses and all kinds of stuff. Some of them have got a bit of factory money behind them, some don't. I mean, it's nowhere near what it was like with the Toka super touring days of the late 90s, but that pretty much cannibalized itself because it cost so much money to do. I mean, they had budgets of like $10 million a year in 1998, which is not...
For a domestic touring car competition.
For a domestic touring car championship, yeah. Having said that, I think Triple Eight's budget is probably at least that. In 2018, but they've also got to make all the shit for all the other teams as well. So
it's kind of offset by the fact that they're then selling a significant chunk of what they do to other people.
Exactly right, and they you know, withhold and they own a lot of the IP of it. So, and the World Touring Cars have switched to TCR, and their first round is on this weekend. But I'm not sure anybody gives a fuck. At least they've got a bigger grid than they had back in the World Touring Car days.
I'll watch the two races that support the N24 later in the year.
Yeah. Well, the ones I always watch are the Nürburgring ones and the Macau ones. And the rest of them I will catch up with on YouTube eventually if they're, you know, when they're on. You know, it's like the sort of thing, like, you've got to...
When the highlights eventually pop up on the homepage and just happen to go, oh, yeah, I'll watch that.
Or they... somebody usually burns them, and it doesn't seem that the series really gives a fuck, so they...
They'll take any eyeball they can get.
Yeah, they're like, fuck, this thing's not going so well that we can afford to just look after it without it.
Well, if memory serves, they're not a world championship anymore. They've lost that.
I think they're a cup. They're a world cup. Because you need a certain number of manufacturers to be a World Championship, which was why it took a while for GTE in the World Endurance Championship to become a World Championship. It was a World Cup for drivers until relatively recently, which is madness because they have like 473 manufacturers in there at the moment. BMW have just joined them as well.
Yeah, it reminds me. I need to look at what's happening in the prologue. I think they're still going because part of it was like a 24-hour.
It was a 30-hour test, which is a lot of hours. Apparently,
I've seen on Instagram the Toyotas have done like 400,000 laps or something.
They have. Well, they were like, obviously they were much quicker than the LMP1 privateers to start with because their cars had been sorted and all the LMP1 privateer cars were literally being put together out of the crate when they got them there. But apparently through the night, the privateer guys have been able to stitch together some better times. So they're obviously not going to out-qualify them, but they just have to be within a couple seconds a lap. They need to just be quicker than an LMP2 car, and you're not that much slower than the hybrids, and they're in position for when their business case depends on the Toyotas falling over, but Toyotas have fallen over in every Le Mans that we've had. Toyotas have been in. If they hadn't, they would have won them. It's kind of how that works.
I'm really, really struggling to get excited about the WEC this year, and I've been following it since it was what the since Intercontinental it was, Le Mans Cup was about when I started watching it.
Yeah, well, I didn't watch it because I didn't have footage, but I always used to watch a stolen stream of the Le Mans 24 Hours or bits of it, dodgy internet Eurosport feed.
But between the Toyotas and the LMP1 privateers, and there being basically no one else at the front of the field, and This whole idea of the super season, which is just they've possibly picked the worst name for what this is this year.
Yeah, it's not a lot of super about it. I think they are slowly making the right decisions for some things, like the idea of with the Sebring doubleheader, making it a Friday race over 8 hours seems to be a much more sensible idea than making
a much better idea than the original one, which was going to start at like 2 o'clock in the morning local time after the 12-hour.
It's like the dumbest idea in the fucking world. And
who is going to watch that? I mean, that makes no sense for anyone.
Yeah, and now you could run both races if you're an LMP2 team, which is you'd be mad, but you could do it. And
it's certainly better than the... Was it the first year of the WEC where they ran in the Sebring 12-hour?
They ran in the same race, but we under it for different points and with different... You've told the story before, but it was just a complete disaster. But it also gives everyone plenty of time when they've also had plenty of sleep to remodel the racetrack and all the shit that they have to do for a WEC event versus an IMSA event. And down the track, maybe they'll run it. I think the ACO's hope is that they'll run it as one event, and maybe they'll have separate points. But I think they want to be part of the 12 hours. They really want to claim the 12 hours.
If they want to do that, they need to piss off LMP1 and adopt DPI.
Well, I get a feeling that LMP1 is going to look like DPI. By the time we get to sort of 2020, 2021, I think LMP1 is going to look a lot like DPI. It's going to be kind of silhouette chassis type, it's going to be set chassis manufacturers with factory bodywork and factory engines. It's going to be like a super DPI. That would be my guess for where they're going with it. And the things will probably look like hypercars, they'll look like Valkyries and that.
No, I don't think they'll do that. I think they'll certainly keep them as a distinct, that prototype shape.
I don't know, because...
That they both have at the moment.
I think
we're going to end up back at that sort of GTP.
I don't think, well, we're not going to go quite to that, because, I mean, aerodynamically, you couldn't get a hypercar-shaped car to have the aero of a prototype. That'd always be at an aero disadvantage compared to even an LMP2 car. But I think they'll definitely take a lot more cues than even the DPI cars have had, where it's been basically take an LMP2 car, give it Cadillac headlights, and off you go, which is pretty much what we've had.
Yeah, but I think they should just do that. Just do that. Just homologate it so that all the IMSA guys can go and race at Le Mans.
It fucking works. Well, they can anyway. I mean, there's nothing to stop the ACO from just saying, yo, DPI class at Le Mans.
You want them all as one class. You don't want sort of, European prototype, which is slightly different to the American prototype, which is slightly different to LMP2, which is slightly different to something else.
Well, the thing is that I think the differences in performance between them wouldn't make a lot of difference after 24 hours, because it'll be whoever, even if they're half a second or 2 seconds a lap different, it'll be whoever nails their pit stops he gets the best fuel economy, he doesn't trip over anyone.
You don't want the entire race to be punctuated with, well, they're not actually racing each other, they're racing in different classes, so it's not really a battle for position, even though it is. It's just an unnecessary level of just pretentious bullshit.
But they used to do that all the bloody time. You know, that was pretty much what the thing was like in the particular sort of the late 90s. You had LMP675 and LMP900, and you had the IMSA bit, and you had this, and you had lots of different classes that were sitting within the same... was the same race, and pretty much the response was just to go, you know, what's the overall, and who's the leading GT, and that's kind of what it sort of defaults to. But no, I take your point. It'd be better if you could find a way that for them all to run together, and with balanced performance, there's no reason they shouldn't be able to do that. But it's just a matter of will, and it's a matter of the ACO wanting to concede, because they want to negotiate, but none of it seems to involve concessions from them yet. So, no. But maybe the idea of stepping back to an 8-hour race is part of their concession. You know, it's because that means they're officially on the Sebring undercard. They're in the space that the fucking Continental Tire 150-mile race would normally be on the Friday.
Oh, it's going to be disappointing if the Conti guys don't get a run.
They'll get a run.
They'll be a shorter run.
They'll be the Michelin guys instead, because they're changing tire sponsors for next year, because Michelin's taking over from Conti. Conti were talking to IndyCar about whether the contract for tyres there was up for bidding, but I think given that Conti kept having all those failures in the Daytona 24, I don't think the IndyCar guys would have been that confident with setting aside what is a really good product in Firestone and moving across to that.
They've had those Firestones forever, haven't they?
Well, Firestone go back to... Well, Firestone and Bridgestone were effectively the same company, but Firestone go back to... Well, they came back into IndyCar in the late 90s, and they've been part of IndyCar and Champ Car ever since. And they know how to make a tire in an IndyCar and make it not explode when you're going 240 miles an hour around the brickyard, which is really important if you're
doing that.
I think so. I think that's important. So IndyCar are on this weekend. As we discussed through other media channels, doesn't appear to be live, although it might be live on the ESPN Watch app thing.
Maybe it will be live on there, yes. But that's the one thing I haven't checked.
Yeah, it's. I had a look, but for some reason it wasn't updating for that. But I did see it's been...
It's certainly not live on the television, because they've got to show American college softball.
Yeah, they've got
college, in Australia and New Zealand, really relevant.
Yeah, but there's actual Australians and New Zealanders racing in Phoenix. And we've got to see the fucking some college.
Admittedly, one channel's showing the NBA and the other one's showing, I don't even know.
It's probably college basketball.
I don't think it's even that.
It might be MLB, because the baseball season started and they show like 47 games a week. So
is this the point where I admit that I actually bought the streaming package for the MLB this year?
Oh my God. Why? You've got ESPN. How much chewing tobacco can one man get through?
Mate, I work in an office. I've got... find a way to keep myself entertained. I want to watch the San Francisco Giants be shit again.
Yep. You could be watching Blancpain. You could be... I can't say
no,
that.
No, you see, here's
face.
My problem. If it's car racing, I want to concentrate on it, and I can't do that. It used to be something I could just have on in the corner of my eye and just glance at every 10 minutes.
See, I have that relationship with long-distance endurance motor racing. You know, I just need someone to tell me what's going on every half an hour, I'm fine. European Le Mans or some shit like that, that's perfect.
Oh, yeah, I can't do that. I have to watch it.
I have to pay attention to it.
Yeah. Otherwise, I get annoyed. Oh, this happened. Well, why didn't I say it?
Well, this is kind of a preview episode. So, who's going to win everything? Go.
Mercedes are going to win Formula One.
Correct.
I suspect Penske's going to come good and win the supercars.
Well, you'd like to think they would, given the amount of resourcing and the fact that McLaughlin has... You know, he came so close last year, but he hasn't yet shown that blinding, blistering pace. I think the ZB might be a good bit of kit.
Realistically, it's probably going to be two girls again.
Well, he'll always be there. I mean, I'd like to see somebody else win it just for the sake of somebody else. But when would you bet against Triple Eight?
Yeah, that's the problem. What else have I got open in front of me?
IndyCars. I mean, I'd like it not to be Penske, but because Penske are like racing Mormons, but I don't think it's going to be.
Well, how I watched the St. Pete Grand Prix the day or two after it happened. How good was that race?
It's a really good race, and that's what happens.
That was a very good race.
Exactly what Formula One needs to do, which is take all the fucking downforce out of them, make them look good, And they all instantly race better, and it was a really good race. And
I just love the fact that a rookie basically led that entire race up until the point he was punted off the road
on the last lap. Well, a rookie
on the second to last lap.
A rookie in his inverted commas, because he had been racing for Mercedes in DTM for years, and he'd been a Formula One test driver and shit. But apart from that, he was a total rookie.
Apart from that.
IndyCar, but that was the thing, is that IndyCar team owners were looking for guys who'd come from series that had lots of power and not a lot of downforce, which is why DTM guys were being looked at, which was why Ganassi signed a contract with Brendan Hartley before Toro Rosso bought that contract out. It was because they'd had experience with cars that had a lot of power and not a lot of downforce. But Wickens has been, in fact, Wickens has qualified in the top six for this Phoenix race, which will be his first ever oval race. And he reckons that the fact that in DTM, the soft tyres they use are peaky as fuck and you get one lap out of them, so you absolutely have to deliver when you get your one lap, was really handy for IndyCar qualifying, because it's kind of the same thing, not because the tyres are limited, but because of the time is limited. And, you know, it's almost like particularly with the top six, the
Super Six or whatever they call it.
Yeah, well, they call it the Fast Six, is you get a very limited amount of time to get your lap in. So you've really got to perform on the number.
On the spot. Hopefully that race is on the line somewhere so I can watch it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Because it'll be on at a reasonable time of morning, which before the supercars. So it'd be nice to go from one to the other.
Well, it seems to be on, it's going to be on ESPN at 7 p.m. as a replay. So it's probably going to be on exactly the same, towards the back end of the V8 race although on Sundays they run earlier, don't they, on V8 races. So the V8 race might actually be done by the time they show the replay. But Twitter will have spoiled the fucking thing by then.
Yeah, I don't follow brands and series on Twitter, so that kind of helps.
Oh, somebody would have said, oh, it's a great thing. Yeah. But it's an overrun.
If anyone has, it's going to have been you. You're the most likely person to post in my stream about IndyCar.
Only if I've watched it, though, I think. And maybe
that's true. If you haven't watched it, we'll be watching it together.
Yes. How lovely. So I'd like to see Scott Dixon win, because I always like seeing Scott Dixon win, because it means New Zealand feels good about itself. But the MotoGP, I reckon Marquez, because Honda, because he's good. Because I don't believe Ducati will be able to sustain the charge, given that Lorenzo's feuding with the team and with Dovizioso over the fact that he's trying to get a new contract and they don't want to pay him very much because he's no good. And Yamaha just don't seem to be fucking clueless, which is a damn shame for Rossi and Vinales. What else is there?
Well, there's the WEC, which shouldn't be Toyota easily.
If it's not Toyota, then you'd want to know why.
Although, in the GT.
Yeah, that should be fun. Although I feel like Porsche are going to be there just because it's their second year with that trick new RSR. And
it does look like a good car, doesn't it?
And it sounds good too. And it appears to be, it was quick in the prologue. I just feel like Porsche are the best because they've got a lot of people who know exactly how to make. There's going to be good people flowing back into the GT program from the LMP program. I mean, obviously,
none of them are going over to make the to run the Formula E program.
Well, there's definitely going to be expertise flow back to the GP, the GT team, which will make them the best at the best race team, I think. Because it's sure as fuck isn't Chip Ganassi's lot, because they're Muppets.
No, and it's not going to be Ferrari, because it never is.
No, not really. No, although they've got Fisichella,
and it won't be BMW because they've got a brand new car. And
they do. Although apparently they were just as quick as the Porsches in prologue testing. So it tells you that the
maybe the mate is good.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you might. Tells you that they got a good bounce from balance of performance after complaining about it in at Daytona.
Yes, I forgot about that.
What else is there? I think that's pretty much it. There's a bunch of other series that will continue to travel on in the background, but we'll talk about them as and when they come up. It's been another fun Motorsport Nerd Pod. Thanks for joining us this week, Bernie.
You're more than welcome.
And we'll talk to you again before the end of the season to see whether any of this shit was correct. Folks, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'm sorry, you're just as big a motorsport nerd as Bernie and I. It's not much we can do about that. You can follow us on the socials on the Bulls Podcast. You follow Bernie at BernieTB. You can follow me at Dr. Yobbo. Bezo will be back next week to talk about how he lost the NBA tipping competition and now owes me an entire carton of beer, which he'll never pay because he's cheap. And we'll talk to you next week.